People are endlessly fascinating, and if you don't think that's true, you're listening to the wrong show. One of the ways of shining a light on how people behave and how they perform is through economics. Now, don't touch anything. Stay with me. It's going to be worth it. Economics turns out to be a useful tool for examining all sorts of things about human beings. So today we're beginning a new series of fortnightly conversations, Ryside Economics, with Andrew Lee. Andrew is one of the country's most interesting thinkers. He's a professor at the ANU and his research covers a ridiculously broad range of topics. Last time he was on the show, he talked about where tall, short, heavy and skinny people live and how this seems to correlate with their incomes. Today, we're going to talk about the life cycle of innovators. When do people hit their creative peaks? Hi, Andrew.
G'day, Richard.
I'm not sure I've hit mine yet. How about you?
I'm hoping I haven't, but don't we all just hope we haven't hit our creative peak? Unless, of course, we won a Nobel Prize.
It could be that I have hit it, but that it was insufficiently large for me to notice. I was thinking.
More of a molehill than a mountain?
Yeah. That's my concern. But look, if I was a mathematician, in all likelihood, I'd now be past my prime.
Yes, that's absolutely right. There's a lovely poem written by somebody who won the physics Nobel Prize saying it's all downhill after 30. You all just have to, you've got nothing to look forward to. Yeah, but it's not entirely true even in maths and physics. The innovators there are doing lots of good work, even into their 40s, as late as that.
But Terence Tao, the Australian who's now at UCLA, he won, well, there's no maths Nobel, but there is the Fields Medal. He won that at 31.
Extraordinary.
But it does reflect that tendency of the feeling that mathematicians do their best and most innovative work perhaps in their 20s and early 30s.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And there's certain fields, particularly the hard sciences, where creativity tends to peak a little earlier than it does sometimes in the creative arts. But even within the creative arts, there's differences.
And an area that marries several things, like architecture, architects can look forward to hitting their peaks much later than their 30s.
Yes, and so it sort of depends on different styles. There's this interesting work by University of Chicago economist David Gallinson, which says that there's two styles of innovators. There's conceptualists who have one big idea. This is like Isaiah Berlin's hedgehogs, if you like. Or experimentalists who have lots of ideas and sort of play and tinker around for many years before they really hit on their master work. Isaiah Berlin's foxes, if you like.
Yeah.
And Gallinson argues that the conceptualists peak early, typically in their 20s or 30s, whereas the experimentalists tend to peak in their 40s, 50s, 60s.
Give me an example.
Well, if we take the example of art, the classic example is Picasso, whose most valuable work is the work he painted in his 20s, and Cezanne, whose most famous work is that he painted in his 60s and peaking even in the work that he did in the year of his death when he was 67.
But didn't Picasso paint Guernica after his 20s? That's regarded as perhaps the greatest thing that he ever did.
Well, if you track through auction prices, perhaps this is a feature of the fact that Guernica hasn't gone to auction. But if you track Picasso's auction prices against his age, then the line steadily slopes down from his 20s onwards. There's certainly ups and downs. There are some solid works, but his huge creative outburst seems to be in the 20s.
Where does somebody like Mozart fit in this? Because he was playing publicly to acclaim it when he was sort of 6 and 7.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mozart is definitely a conceptualist, somebody who's begins with great ideas and who really peaks very much into his 20s and 30s. I don't think Gallinson's actually studied musicians, so you know, it's a little of a stretch to try and apply this to musicians, but Mozart would definitely be in that conceptualist basket.
I think you should study musicians because I think there's certainly an argument that music's the greatest of all the arts, and it'd be interesting to hear how the musicians break down if they still fall into those two categories.
That's absolutely right. And then you'd think of somebody like Wagner, who, for example, tinkered and experimented for much longer and plausibly did his better work later in his career.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Andrew Lee. We're having the first of our fortnightly conversations. We're going to do them on Thursdays, which we're calling Ryside Economics. Today we're looking at when your creative peak might be, and we're specifically applying this to geniuses, but it could well apply to you too. It does seem a bit neat, this Galanson's work, these two tidy categories. Surely the real world's a bit messier than this.
The real world is always messier than that. And I think one of the things that economists get criticised for is trying to simplify. But a model that is as complex as the real world itself is a useless model. In some sense, what economics is trying to do is to say, let's see if there is a simpler conception of looking at a particular field. So in this case, innovation, which loses some detail but still provides a little insight by breaking it down. And then let's try and gather together some empirical data on great works across fields. And this is where Galanson really gets into trouble, where he draws his data from art auction prices, or for example from the number of times poems appear in anthologies, the number of times particular buildings appear in architecture textbooks, and then from that he gets his list of masterworks, and then he's able to look at when the masterworks were produced, whether they were produced early on in a creative person's career or later in the creative person's career.
How is his work going down among the artists and poets?
I think it would be fair to say badly. I'm not aware of Galanson receiving plaudits in these fields. I mean, it is kind of an extraordinary enterprise to dive not only into one field of creative endeavour, but then to pretend that you can actually say something new about the creative split in not only art, but also architecture, novelists, poets. He even has a paper on conceptualists and experimentalists among film directors.
Right. It just seems at the heart of creativity, there's some mystery. And it's difficult, it seems to me, to be empirical about it.
I think that's right, but you can certainly see clear patterns. So in one of his papers, he has a lovely story of Vasily Kandinsky, who walked into his studio in his late 40s and saw what he described as an indescribably beautiful picture pervaded by an inner glow. Turned out to be an earlier picture of his that was just sitting on the side. and it completely changed the way in which he began painting. And he then started to search for forms which were expressive but unrelated to real objects. And this sort of teasing around, this sense that you don't begin your career with a great idea, but you're searching through a process of art as a journey, if you like. There's something in that, I think.
Yeah, all right. I have to admit, I find this fascinating, and clearly you do too, Andrew, but why does it matter?
Well, it matters if you're, from a public policy point of view, if you're handing out money. So we can make two kinds of mistakes if we're handing out money. We can hand out too much money to young people who look promising on paper, but whose ideas ultimately don't go anywhere. Fizzling fireworks, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can hand out too much money to people whose best work is behind them. Extinct volcanoes, if you like. And the question is how you make this error as little as possible. How you try and avoid giving too much money to fizzling fireworks or extinct volcanoes. And it may well be that funding bodies want to start looking at Galanson's work and saying, well, is this person primarily a conceptualist or are they primarily an experimentalist? And if they're an experimentalist, you might want to be more positive about giving money later in the career than you would if you thought they were a conceptualist.
The thing about the experimentalist, it seems to me, there's an obvious mistake that you can make if you're going to give them money. How do you know if you're dealing with an experimentalist genius who in his or her 50s or 60s is going to produce something remarkable, or dealing with somebody who's just rubbish?
Yes, I mean, I guess you would hope that you can see some sort of a portfolio of work which is steadily building later on in the career. In my own profession, the Nobel Prize a few years ago went to an economist by the name of Robert Fogel for work that he did in his early 60s on slavery. And there's a lovely part in the introduction to one of those to his book where he says, I was nearly ready to publish 2 years ago, but I just wasn't quite sure. So I spent a bit more time garnering the data and going through it until I was really sure that I understood the economics of slavery. So you want to be sure that you recognise that kind of work can take many decades to come to fruition.
The thing about the Nobels, of course, is they're only offered in a few areas, and they are, to an extent, subject to human judgments from the judges. So I'm thinking, what, and I suppose I'm arguing that they're slightly an imperfect guide, because if you nearly got the Nobel the year before and it's outstanding work, does it mean that you're still kind of in front of mind for the judges? I mean, what I'm essentially getting around to saying in a rather long way is that you get a a backlog building up, don't you?
Absolutely. And this is a problem in economics, possibly more than in any other area. We have probably a dozen people who are sort of ready to get the Nobel Prize. And the only question is, you know, will they stay alive long enough to still be in contention? But the Nobel is still a useful, although naturally flawed, signal of who's at the top of the field. And in economics, physics, chemistry, medicine, you can see the age of Nobel Prize winners, the age at which they did their best work, steadily rising over time. So Benjamin Jones, who's another researcher that looks at these creative life cycles, takes a different approach from Gallinson. Gallinson looks at the two styles of innovators. Ben Jones looks at the way the field develops and says, well, look, the age of Nobel-winning work has gone up because the frontier has been pushed out. And so it's hard, it takes longer to get to the frontier to make a great breakthrough.
But surely it depends on the field that you're in. I mean, if you're in, I don't know, if you're in computer software 30 years ago, you were almost inevitably at the frontier compared to now.
That's absolutely right. So there's this Thomas Kuhn distinction between, which is a great philosopher of science, distinction between accumulation, which is the normal process of scientific discovery, and revolutions. So, for example, you can think of a revolution in physics as being the early 20th century quantum mechanics revolution. And when a revolution is afoot, it's very easy for someone in their early 20s to make breakthroughs. And so, as you say, the Bill Gates, Sergey Brin's, Larry Page's, all of the new innovators when the internet is young tend to be young people themselves. Now I think it's much harder to make a breakthrough in computer programming. So the great programmers will probably tend to make the greatest contributions at an older age.
Right, they'll be experimentalists, in fact.
Exactly.
We come back to where we started. Andrew, what is it that interests you about this kind of research? Because it's really sort of outside the territory of conventional economics.
It is little, though. If you think of economics as being trying to understand incentives and trying to understand the process of innovation, this is pretty core to what we do. And so, thinking systematically about when breakthroughs are made, trying to understand knowledge endeavors not just as sort of isolated events, but thinking about the sort of systems that, for example, push out the frontier of knowledge and then suddenly shrink it back when a revolution in ideas comes. Yeah, I mean, I think of economics as essentially a set of tools that can be used to attack all kinds of different problems.
Thanks very much for kicking off Riseside Economics today. We'll have more in a fortnight.
Pleasure. Thanks, Richard.
That's Andrew Lee, who is a professor of economics at the ridiculously young age of 36 at the Australian National University. And as I said, more from Andrew in a fortnight.